Unpack your knives and stay for the Top Chef Judges Roundtable podcast here on Reality TV Wrap-Ups. Hey, everybody. Mike Bloom here, back with a bit different team of four, but still a team of four to talk through part two of this season's three-team Restaurant Wars extravaganza on Top Chef Kentucky. Let me bring in someone familiar, someone who we had on last week by my side to talk through the first part of Restaurant Wars, Antonio Mazzaro. Antonio, how are you?
Mike, I'm fine. The extra vaganza is too much for me. I just want a vaganza. Is that too much to ask?
No, the ganza comes with extra on the side, which might have muddled the dish a bit. Nilo Matamed was disparaging the extra a bit. But let me also bring in the great Josh Wiggler. Josh, how you doing? Welcome back.
I'll have the vaganza you don't want, Antonio. You can just send it down to the side of the table.
Perfect.
And take care of
perfect.
That.
Sounds good.
There we go. Family style. And of course, we are bringing back the full OG Top Chef recap crew. You haven't heard this guy since the very first week. He has done some worldly traveling to the third coast and beyond, but now he's back. Kurt Clark, how you doing?
Pretty good. If you're not sure which person at the round table is me, I'm the banging hot one. Okay, wait, well, we're all banging hot. We're all banging hot.
In the power rankings, though, you are number one. With a bullet, I would say.
Now, I'm going to go a bit unconventional here, gentlemen. I take a lot of pride in the coterie of listeners that we have from a wide swath of ages and geography, etc. But I want to sort of mold this podcast differently. I want to make this podcast for one person in particular. And I'm speaking to the person who brought the banana into this season's Restaurant Wars. You, sir or ma'am, are an American hero. Your planning and sense of realization that you're going to be working into one of the worst Restaurant Wars experiences in history, and you walked out with a full stomach no matter what was put in front of your plate, it's really fantastic planning. And I advise anyone who participates in a Top Chef challenge like this in the future, maybe smuggling some food in might not necessarily be a bad idea, because I think this person got out pretty well off considering how Third Coast went along and got a bit of potassium along the way.
Are we going to start seeing whoever's running front of house, like, mandating that there be a fruit bowl at reception, like when people check in? Like we've seen them serve drinks there before, like for people waiting, but maybe they need to get something like some crudité or something.
Taking it a little further, I think we might just see an onslaught of pocket bananas now, Kurt, which is never a bad idea anyway.
I'm kind of feeling insulted because I thought that I had pioneered the pocket banana tactic, and now I'm seeing it on Top Chef, and I'm wondering, is my apartment bugged, or am I just basic, and the pocket banana is more widespread than I've known?
If a pocket plantain is something that was popular in Miami when I lived there, so you have to be careful.
And I did pioneer the pocket cookie during the recent Canadian know-it-alls a couple years back, so I fully approve the idea of pocket food when you're not sure when you're going to get to nosh.
Pocket pizza, has that caught on yet, or am I still ahead of the curve?
Pizza pockets.
Right, but it's different.
You need sauce-resistant pockets in order to perfect the pizza pocket.
What kind of pants do you have? I thought this is the only kind to get these days.
Italian pants, sir. All the pockets are sauce resistant. I think I saw Stanley from The Office do the pocket pizza, Josh. So that's just something.
Okay,
I
so I'm out.
Are you sure that's
out.
Not pocket pretzels?
He also likes the pretzels. Let's put it this way. It's not a Kentucky thing that I know of, but it certainly seems to be a brilliant move, as you're observing, Mike, to bring the pocket banana. A really funny moment, for sure, because where do you get it? I don't know. Like, where somebody comes up with a banana, what are you going to do? But it definitely seemed to be appropriate in the moment for that team. Perhaps it's a Third Coast tradition.
Yeah, I think that maybe if you're looking for a microcosm that represents the hot mess that was Third Coast front of house service, Nini was able to get someone to come in with contraband, which I don't think we've ever had on Top Chef before. So I think that just screams maybe how the team that was poised to do the best ended up doing quite the opposite. But before we get into the actual service itself, Josh, Kurt, neither one of you were here last week when we started off talking about this new three-team, two-part version of this season's Restaurant Wars. Now that all is said and done, maybe not to go too much into the intricate elements as to how each dish turned out, but in terms of both concept and execution, how are you two feeling about the way they did Restaurant Wars this season?
Kurt, you've been away for longer. Why don't you take this first spin?
After listening to last week's podcast, I think I fall in the Haley camp of I don't hate it. I definitely don't feel as strongly as everybody else in the podcast seemed to. Although we did have the guest judge who was at the table, who I'm looking through my notes and I'm not seeing her name.
I believe her name was Caroline or Carolyn.
Yes, she not from The Apprentice. She raised the fact that it's, you know, it's, or maybe it was even, I think it was her, and I don't think it was Nina, who raised the point that, you know, and you guys raised it as well last week, the fact that, you know, you're now asking these people who don't necessarily know each other as well as they should or might to have to work together, much more of a pressure cooker. But I didn't hate it. I think it created its own unique set of circumstances, along with the fact, again, that you have this now, the people designing the front of house and the restaurant not necessarily having all their shit together and ready for, you know, the things that need to be done. But I fall in the Haley Strong camp of, well, you know, I didn't hate it. It was a new twist, and I just was just interested to see how it was going to go.
Yeah, I don't love it. I don't like it. I'm not thrilled with it. I think that splitting restaurant wars across two episodes to begin with, where you're not going to have an elimination in the first episode, is already just like a little bit of a dicey prospect for me. But I think it's tolerable when it's late into the season and you're really invested in a whole, you know, you're invested in a lot of people, but maybe not 12 people's worth of stories that you're trying to track. I still feel like this early on in a season of Top Chef, you're in the stage of getting to know these people. Like, I don't feel like I know all of these people extremely well, and I certainly don't know them well enough to track them through the chaos of restaurant wars where there are now three teams to be tracking. I thought this past episode, the one we're talking about today, was as a result very messy. Like, it was just, there was so much to keep an eye on, and it felt like the final stretch of a normal episode of Top Chef extended across a full hour, and it was so chaotic. It was so much. And I think now we're in this place where the rest of the season for me, I don't know. I think Restaurant Wars is one of those things where you feel like it's either the end of an act or the start of the next phase of the season. Like, it's a real pivot point for a season of Top Chef, and for it to happen within the first five episodes, really to start within the first four episodes, just way too early, I think. And it really didn't pay off well for me. I think it really landed with a thud for me, as frankly a lot of this season has for me so far.
Yeah, I think you raise a good point about the structure. Is like, you, a normal hour, you got those interstitials that set up the milestones of a Top Chef episode. You've got the quick fire interstitial and the quick fire challenge, followed by the elimination challenge, followed by the judges table, and really you set up those key points of prepping and setting up and all the drama during, I think, that first part, where, like you said, it just really, the second episode was really just a prolonged back half of a normal episode. So I do see your point there.
And I think also when you have restaurant wars deeper into a season, like, you run yourself into the situations where She Who Must Not Be Named from Top Chef Seattle, who you've had, you know, several episodes now to, like, know what her dynamic is like with other chefs and the specific personality quirks of that person and how it's rubbing wrong against other people. Like, now Restaurant Wars is very loaded with the anticipation of, like, how that's going to explode or what's the reaction to that going to be. And I just don't think we know these people well enough yet to have those levels of expectations into exactly how the Kentucky Restaurant Wars was going to play out. I just feel like I think Restaurant Wars plays the best when there's a lot of hype going into it. And so to have a surprise early Restaurant Wars, while I understand that the chefs are surprised, I don't think that it really benefits us as a viewer very much at all, if at all.
Would it have been more digestible for you guys if, rather than spread across 2 weeks, and this was proposed last week, I believe, it was aired as one two-hour block? So it was more, less maybe two episodes and more like one supersized episode, because I do see the point of making it a two-hour thing due to there being three kitchens and a lot of storylines to keep track of, and everything that was sort of set up last week paid off in one way or another this week. But to your point, Josh, I think that stretching it across it also didn't benefit from the fact that we all made these predictions as to who was going to go home last week, and it ended up being the exact same people. And so when you're sort of building to what seemed like an inevitable conclusion about 20 minutes into this episode, it doesn't exactly help the pacing of the episode proper.
I think, I mean, it would have fixed the idea once it had been executed. Like, I mean, there's only so much you can do once they decided in production, like, we're going to do Restaurant Wars in the fourth cycle. Like, once that goes forward, you now have to, I think just from a premise standpoint, I think it's a flawed one. So I think that once that's already executed, I think that the best move there is to make it a 2-hour night of television, to split it across 2 weeks for all the reasons you've said, I think is a bad choice.
Or make it a 90-minute episode with no quickfire.
Exactly. Yeah.
But in Canada, it's still going to be like 60 minutes.
Yeah. I'm curious. Yeah. What Haley's half hour Restaurant Wars was like.
Yeah, just a lot of condensed. Well, Antonio, we sort of talked about the setup for everything last week. This week, we finally get the service. Overall, how do you feel about how this challenge ended up playing out? Do you agree with these guys?
It delivered what I think I expected. Top Chef California does the pop-up pandemonium episode, which was the second episode of the season when they had 16 chefs, I believe, in the competition. And they did 4 pop-up restaurants with menus that matched what the neighborhood the restaurant was in. And it was a story about, this is what LA is like. You have Korean food, you have Mexican food, you have this vegan scene, you have this Persian scene. So that was an instance where, like what Josh is saying, we don't really know the stories of these chefs. So we didn't have the same stakes as the later season Restaurant Wars, where they did the double. And they did the breakfast and lunch, and we split it up, and we had a very different Restaurant Wars experience in that particular season than we had previously. And that one, that Restaurant Wars experience did speak to, I believe, a lot of the candidate or the contestants' personalities. The good story in that one, of course, was that Isaac was drafted last and ended up winning Restaurant War, spoiler alert. So there was, and Philip went home. And Philip going home was this culmination of everything that Philip had been doing and experiencing up to that point. So I do agree with Josh that the later placement in the season gives you the opportunity to tell these chef testant stories a lot better. That said, I do think the story of Brian was a good story that we've had throughout the first few episodes. And seeing the culmination in Restaurant Wars, the payoff was still there. Maybe his peak came sooner than it would have had it not been the Restaurant Wars realm, or maybe it was a different kind of peak. Well, it remains to be seen, I think, how the stories that were told in these episodes do play out the rest of the season. I'm frustrated, as I said last week, still, that the Kentucky has been taken out of the sales of this season because you did the Christmas challenge followed by a 2-part Restaurant Wars. That's my number one frustration with this. I actually like that the chef testants weren't calling what was happening. They weren't aware it was coming. I like to shake that up a little bit. And I like that chef testants can't just assume that they know what's coming next. And so I understand the desire from a production standpoint to move it around. The reality of how that played out wasn't great. And I do think, as Josh is observing, you do lose a lot of the storytelling capabilities of Restaurant Wars. I'm not saying we didn't get stories. The fallout from Restaurant Wars is yet to be seen. And it's significantly impacted by what's happening with Last Chance Kitchen. So that's another story and another piece of this, which does impact ultimately who went home and who might be coming back. And well, I'm sure we'll talk about that.
And I'm still not sure exactly why it is that things ended up with as such a cluster. I'm really not that convinced that it's because the players didn't know each other that well. I mean, you had 4 of the chefs, you know, hot tubbing together and just, you know, very chill. You had Adrian very comfortable with, you know, taking that commanding lead. But so I'm like, it's a mix of with, you know, you have 12 chefs and the editors weren't sure how to edit together a story using those chefs. You had contestants who weren't necessarily that used to still being on a competition show as they would be 4 episodes later. You had the whole, you know, the restaurant not being ready. So I'm not entirely sure which element it was that primarily led to it kind of being such a cluster of an episode. Was it just the wrong people being put in the wrong positions? But it's probably a little from each column. But it definitely, you know, the end result was messy. But at the same time, I enjoyed the mess. I mean, I'm there to watch the train wreck. So
I think the just to float a theory out there of some of that messiness. I think one of the reasons why Restaurant Wars for me, I think for other people too, it seems like why it doesn't work so well here so early in a season of Top Chef is because as accomplished as these people are at what they do, they wouldn't be on the show if not. competing on a reality show like this is a totally different beast. So the chef testants just don't have their top chef sea legs underneath them yet. And I think Restaurant Wars is, it seems by most accounts, the most difficult challenge on Top Chef, that like you're setting up a restaurant, you've got 48 hours to do it when you normally have months to put something like this together. And I think to have that later in a season, once they're a little more used to the rhythm of Top Chef, I bet that makes a big difference as opposed to putting it in as the fourth elimination challenge of the season. I got to imagine that that plays a role in the messiness.
Yeah. And it's also a bit of like, I mean, this group in particular, especially early on, seems to be going through a lot of the gauntlet in terms of, you know, having this big team challenge. And then they were cooking desserts at 3 a.m. and now they're doing Restaurant Wars in 48 hours, you know, with people that they've known for like a couple of weeks. It's a, you know, when Tom says this is the hardest Restaurant Wars, I don't know if that's speaking towards, you know, the hardest to judge. I think it was just the circumstances, and maybe production did sort of force those circumstances. And that actually segues into a bit of, you know, the episode recap, since we have pulled a bit of a Sarah and done an extended introduction into this episode, as it were. Because I want to talk about, Kurt, you were talking about like the idea of, you know, the restaurants not being ready. And that, I think, prolonged a bit of the setting up of everything. But I want to speak to something that was really only the prevalent element of Northeast, you know, service stuff. You know, we actually talked about this last week. Again, another correct prediction on our part that Northeast would be the one who ends up winning. But their only real issue seems to be these damn servers. And we're going to talk about this with Third Coast. I feel like there's a difference between the stuff that happened with, you know, the decor coming together, and I'm just genuinely confused, because it seems like this season, more than ever, they just have a group of people who, I don't know if they've ever been to a restaurant before. Some of these people just have no idea what the basic tenets of serving are.
And I think the reason I brought up the restaurant not being ready is that, you know, Nini vocalized that she didn't feel she could train the servers on like the tables and like where everything was located if the restaurant wasn't ready. So I do see the two being tied together, but you did have those instances in the show where, you know, Nini is arguing with the server over, you know, why the person just needs the soup spoon, and all those these other little elements. So they're but the servers did seem to do have a lot of standing around and not being proactive. And yeah, who are these servers?
May I be heard on this, since these are my people?
I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah, it is a poor craftsman who blames their tools. And I think it would be incredibly coincidental that Third Coast seemed to get only the bad servers. I don't think that's the case at all. I think that that environment in that restaurant was incredibly stressful. I think that the what was coming from the back of the kitchen, especially yelling from Kelsey, yelling at them, to Justin yelling at Kelsey, to David yelling at Nini, yelling at Justin, yelling at Kelsey, and everything those servers were experiencing, that doesn't help. I'm granted they may not have been prepared, but part of the problem is that they weren't prepared by their front of house staff. And that's a choice that Nini made, because she had to spin her ice cream right before the service when the restaurant was actually finally set up by those great artisans from Blueprint. They finally got it done. And once they hung the stupid plates on the wall and made Forrest Gump's Mom's House 2.0, then when the servers were there and the restaurant was there, Nini was not available to train. And we saw that last episode, a half hour before service, Kelsey's yelling at servers. Nobody knows what's going on. I think that is the biggest contributor. There's no way you can tell me that they somehow Jack shepherded all of the poor servers into one team. I know some of these other teams were having some service hiccups, but it seemed like Sarah, and this was presented on the show, she said, you don't yell at your people. You treat them well. You give them opportunities, and you're kind to them, and they will work well for you. We did not see that from Third Coast. We saw them being yelled at, and we saw that in a direct edit on the show. So I think it's wrong to blame the servers completely. We've seen servers have issues on Restaurant Wars in the past. We've seen hilarious servers just overfilling the wine glasses and the water glasses at judges' tables and doing funny things like that. And we've seen all manner of service issues in Top Chef in restaurant wars in the past. It was very clear the person who went home, and the easiest choice, I might add, was the person who was responsible for the front of the house. I understand that that team was want to blame their servers, but I think that is wrong to do so. And I need to stand up for my people in Kentucky. I'm positive those people were capable of doing the job. I'm not saying Nini had a better opportunity. I think the problems of Third Coast were in the planning and execution stages before service ever started. And that has nothing to do with the servers, or very little to do with the servers. Every team had a situation, Kurt, like you're describing, which I do think caused a problem, which is that the restaurant just wasn't ready when they were ready, when the service staff showed up. Nini said to the service staff, polish some silverware. Brian had a service manual ready, so they understood why you needed a soup spoon and when you needed a soup spoon. Nini did not have that, and Sarah didn't have that, but Sarah was ready and focused on the staff as soon as she was able to do so. Nini was back in the kitchen spinning ice cream. So I don't know what to say other than it seemed like it was Third Coast's fault, not the server's fault. Yes, the servers were in a mess once service started, but I don't believe that that was the fault of the servers. They were not told what to do. And I think I honestly believe that Justin should have claimed as much responsibility for this. He's the one expediting the food. We saw Adrian really step up in expediting and say to the servers, like, on a couple of occasions, this isn't right. This ticket isn't right. You need this, this, and this. She said, talk to me from Brian. Don't talk to the back. She was controlling her kitchen. Justin was losing his mind. So it's a failure of the whole team, not just Nini. But that was a team failure that the judges recognized was a team failure and sent the right person home for it, for sure.
If we don't serve together, we're going to die alone.
That team was certainly lost, for sure.
Well, let's get into a bit of the northeast of it all. We'll sort of go in sections. Luckily, as much as we may talk about maybe the scattered editing that comes across, but this team's doing something, then this team's doing something, I feel like the second part does do pretty well in focusing around each of the teams in the moment, even though it might be happening, you know, at the same time chronologically. So let's start with Northeast. I guess before we get into that, we talked about, you know, the blueprint decor. Antonio, you sort of made a tongue-in-cheek reference about that.
It was trash.
Anything stand out from any of you guys about the decor for one reason or another from Northeast, like tree-laden restaurant, even more so than the restaurant that was supposed to be the actual terrarium?
I don't want to say that all it all was trash. The Third Coast one was trash. I actually thought the other two were pretty good. I don't know what you guys thought.
I had no strong opinion on the decor other than it took so long to come together.
Yeah, the problem for me is that there's three restaurants and so many people to keep track of that I wasn't paying attention to the decor at all. There's the whole episode was so chaotic. It was just it was work enough to keep track of which was which. I did not pay attention to the decor at all. I have no comments.
I didn't notice it until I watched it a second time. And I only noticed it the second time because I thought the first time, hey, weren't they supposed to be eating in a greenhouse? And you don't really see it. The camera positioning was such that you didn't get a great look at it. But it is there. It's hanging over one part of Thistle's restaurant. I thought the thistle on the wall had silver, like farm implements, not implements of destruction, but like rakes and hoes and things like that. On one side of the wall, they had a really nice hanging piece, which was the greenhouse piece. There were a lot of hanging plants hanging from that. I thought they had farm style tables. I thought it was a nice spot. And then Northeast was different. It was super sleek. If you watch again, the host stand where everyone's checking in, it's really cool. It's presented in a more sleek kind of modern way than you would expect. And they've got that look throughout the restaurant, including down to the tables. They had the city skyline that they talked about placed on the wall. I thought that actually those two went really well. Third Coast was just mishmash. It looked really poor. I mean, it was just white plates thrown onto the wall with a couple of like maybe antebellum type columns in the middle of the restaurant, and the blue with the white. It just, none of that worked for me. But the other two I thought were pretty nice.
Some pro-bellum columns would have been much better.
Oh, my.
Well, maybe even though you, Kurt and Josh, weren't necessarily paying attention to the decor, you may have been paying attention to our judges panel. I know last week we had speculated as to whether Karen and Nina were going to make a return after sort of just being Jack Shepherded out there for the quick fire. I'm happy to see that they came back. Do you two have any thoughts about seeing these two back for this set of two episodes?
I love Nina Compton so much. So anytime you can get her on a television set, I'm happy. It was just fantastic to see her here.
Yeah, you know, I'm okay with Nina.
Oh, relax.
Oh, boy.
You better relax, bro. Do you think Eddie Money was triggered at all to see her?
I wonder. No, I was expecting to see them back. It was, we didn't really, I think we got a little bit more Karen during this episode. I felt we got more than we did in part one from her. But it's, I liked also, you know, Tom's callbacks. So how did you guys do in Restaurant Wars? And so it was nice to have a little bit of that history injected there.
Yeah. And I also want to, speaking of the judges panel, I want to say something about, because I know I wasn't on in episode two when we introduced Nilu Matamed, as it seems like she's going to be a recurring part, sort of like the Gale analog in this season. I got to say, maybe this was a hot take. I wasn't a big fan of Nilu in episode two, but I got to say she warmed up to me in this episode. I think, honestly, episode two, she was a bit extra, in my opinion. Not so much Vaganza, more extra, just with like the, ooh, this thing is haunting. I understand from like a critical perspective that you have this sort of Rolodex of words where you can't just say it was delicious, it was not good, tasty, etc. But it felt a bit too much to lay on some of these weird adjectives to describe the food. But here I feel like maybe it was scaled back or edited out, but I feel like it was more concentrated criticism. So I'm back on the Nilu train.
So try hard extra, not extraneous extra.
Yes, exactly.
I think we also love Gail Simmons so much here on this podcast, and we in Top Chef Nation are such big fans that anyone who is, even if Gail has the greatest excuse in the universe to not be on Top Chef, I think we're going to be immediately defensive of whoever Top Chef is rolling out to stand in her stead. Maybe here in episode five, you're a little more open to accepting whoever Top Chef is putting forth in place of Gail this season.
And it was nice to see Graham Elliott back. Granted, I mean, he had orange glasses instead of the white glasses, and it's like, oh, I'm sorry, that was Padma. My mistake. I didn't even realize that.
I like how I do, and Sarah observed this, but I like that with Nilu there, it was such a panel of strong women, as Sarah observed. And I think if you're yes. going to take Gail's voice out of the equation, the worst thing you can do, and no offense to any of these, is bring on Graham or Richard Blaze or someone like that as Gail's replacement. I'm happy that we have another strong woman as a replacement for Gail. I agree with Josh as a true Gail stan that I would much rather see the Canadian Queen Gail on the show. But if she's not going to be on the show, please don't replace her with just another white guy. Like, let's get something different here. So glad to hear this particular panel. Open mind on Nilu. I didn't have a negative impression of her at first, but we're going to see her a lot through the rest of the season. So I'm looking forward to seeing what her feedback on these dishes are. And I think she's disagreed a couple of times with some of the judges, or she's been very bold about her thoughts. So I really appreciate that. And I want to see more of that. I like judges table disagreements. I like when mommy and daddy fight. I like when they talk about how
I
didn't think it had too much salt. I didn't think it had too much salt. Oh, I did. Yeah, no, I like that. So if she's going to be the kind of voice that's strong in her opinions and they may not always jibe with everyone else's, I'm here for that. So I'm excited to see where this goes the rest of the season for sure.
Consider us a panel of Gale guys right now.
I like it. I like when mommy reminds daddy that he should leave the party with the date he arrives with.
Awkward.
Yeah. Familiar problem. Absolutely.
Especially for Tom, apparently.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into these Northeast dishes. Josh, were there any that this was a team that did well overall? Did anything stick out to you in particular as something that really made your eyes and tongue pop?
No, really the my biggest takeaway from Northeast was how fantastically Eddie Money reacted at the end of the episode when Money was introduced to the equation.
Finally, I can buy more pork.
I know I'm jumping ahead, but that was really when I think about Northeast, I was dying. I was on the ground laughing so hard at that. That's really
Could you imagine Eddie like now? So was like, now. All right, retribution. I'm going to pay back all my team members for the pork.
You guys get all of my money. Oh man. No, that was really that was it for me. That was it was the funniest thing of the season so far, and it's all that I think about when I think of Northeast.
Kurt, what about you?
I'm not a huge steak fan, but the New York strip was something I was really interested in, as well as Adrian's peach dish for the final course. So this, I think of the three restaurants, this one had the most dishes that I was most interested in trying.
Mm-hmm. What are you thinking, Antonio?
I thought the ballotine looked really incredible. I wanted to try that. And I think that it spoke to a lot about the team. It was a team dish. It was Brian's dish that was a culmination of his career, as he said. But it got done in part because Adrian allowed him to step up during prep, and she went to the front of the house and started the training. It got done because Eddie carried it across the finish line and really delivered on that dish. And it got done because Eric was working on what he was working on, allowing Brian the flexibility to not chip in with them and to just do what he needed to do for that particular dish. So it was, I think, a representation of the quality of the team and the quality of the individual chefs in Brian's case, but also a representation, I thought, of why the team won, which was the teamwork that went into that dish, the putting egos aside, helping each other. Great on Eddie, and a good moment for him in the show when he basically said, like, I don't want Brian to go home, so I'm making this a good dish. Little do you know, Eddie, like, you're helping Brian win by what you're putting, the effort you're putting into this dish. So that looked really incredible to me. It's one of those things where when you say you're going to do Restaurant Wars and you prepare a dish like that, in addition to everything else you're doing, it is impressive. So I can understand why Brian won. That said, I really thought, and this is a different discussion, but I really thought that that even though Brian's dish seemed like maybe the best of the night, and they said that at the end of the three services, that Adrian's work on this team was underrepresented. Mm-hmm. Not underrepresented, yeah. But I think she could easily have won this, and probably should have from just what kept that restaurant together. She got a really good edit on the show, and good for her. And she seemed to do such a fantastic job of really making sure this team stayed on point. The team as a whole, I think, really came off well over these two episodes. And like I said, I really think that ballotine dish is a representation of why, because of the teamwork and the individual quality that the chefs had.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but in this case, the win for Brian was a win in title only. They all received the actual prize, correct?
Yes,
which I was happy to see. Which I was happy to see, for sure.
So was Eddie.
Eddie was again. We're nearing the number of times Eddie has smiled in his life to one hand. We might be getting to two by the end of his competition, whether or not he wins anymore. Yeah, I do agree.
I want Eddie to win so badly. I don't think that words can describe, because I feel like the look on his face if he wins Top Chef is going to be enough to get me through the rest of 2019.
I don't know. I think this is a point where you and Kurt might be agreeing, considering his connection to Nicholas.
No, I understand, and believe me, I'm surprised as well, but I think that he has proven himself to be a darling.
And I like that the judges are kind of in on the joke. At least Padma is with frequent acknowledgments to it's okay to smile, Eddie. So I'm liking that it is part of the narrative of the show now that he's very stoic and panicked.
But I think that stoicism, which I typically don't like in the chefs that sometimes you like, Kurt, I think here it's a lot of it is because of the panic. Like, I think he is just like he's on a frying pan at all times and he is so nervous. And I think it translates beautifully to television. I thought he was my all-star of this episode for sure.
And I think that the point that you're making, Kurt, just speaks towards why this judging panel is, in my opinion, one of the best on reality TV, is because they have their own joke that they acknowledge. It makes me think back to like season 13, where Padma knows that Kwame's crushing on her. And so she always tries to like play it up, having a conversation with him in every quickfire when they make the rounds. Like, they are just such a good group of people that they have their own in jokes that really, you know, reverberate outside of the screen. I do agree with you, Antonio, that I think from our perspective, I could see Adrian making the win as well, because not only did she rule that kitchen with an iron fist and was absolutely necessary, even though we got the sort of out of context clip in previous instances about her saying, you guys pay attention to me, you listen to them, essentially saying like, Brian, don't get involved in my business. She really needed to do that to get all the chaos settled out. And I think her desserts, we're talking about the peaches, the Jasper Hill Farms Harvest and Cheese with the basil focaccia and blackberry was really interesting to me in so many ways. First, I never had Harbison cheese, even though that apparently bridges whenever mommy and daddy get in a fight. Apparently mommy and daddy will just have some Harbison cheese and all will be well, according to Karen.
Or mommy and mommy, right.
But apparently it's like a very sweet cheese, which makes it a good dessert cheese. I'm so intrigued by this basil focaccia, because I know Neely was talking about like just the really cool way that she had, done it. I am stumped as to how she was able to make whatever that chip looking thing was, you know, out of basil focaccia. I guess the color came from the basil, but like, I don't know what preparatory method you use to make it look like that. That just astounded me.
And also I'm thinking with both Adrian and also Nina, it makes me think back to the very first episode when they were both on the team with Brandon. And I think all of us who were, you know, talking about that episode were like, Brandon's walking all over these two during the quick fire and just kind of, and that they seemed both a little bit meeker. And I think in the, you know, the following five episodes now, we've seen that Nene and Adrian, you know, they can take charge. They do take charge. Maybe not a front of house, but they both are very vocal in their own right, especially, you know, Nene had, you know, stepped up and had, you know, two wins. So I really do like the way that we've seen the different sides of these chefs just over these past 6 weeks.
Yeah, and I think that to that point, I mean, Adrian, one of the reasons why she stepped up as executive chef is because she says, you know, I have all this experience expediting, and it definitely shows to the point that you made, Antonio. She kept everything super organized. A couple of things I wanted to touch upon before we leave the Northeast. Yeah, I totally agree about Eddie's New York trip with braised cabbage and the Merlot jus. I mean, it just looked like a fantastic combination, and it's a really cool way to do the, like, typical wine and protein pairing as well. By making the Merlot jus, you're basically putting the red wine in there. I mean, a diner said it was one of the best combinations of flavors that they've done in a long time. So who knows, maybe in a different way, if Adrian and Brian's dish didn't hit as well as they did, maybe Eddie could have won the challenge and gotten an even bigger smile on his face, as crazy as that would have been. I mean, it was pretty clear to me, at least, that this team is going to win. But I guess if they hadn't, you'd have to assume that by default, Eric would be up there, just because the literal only complaint. Actually, Eddie's striped bass crudo got a little bit of, like, someone said it was one note, but Eric probably got the biggest criticism of Northeast in that, you know, his scallop with the couscous and the variations of carrot was cooked well, but the pork was really salty, which seems to be a theme of the season for some reason. People just can't control their salt. So I guess by default, he would have gone home. But the Ballantine, I wonder if, you know, I agree that Adrian, I think from our perspective, should have won just by her management and the fact that she was putting out two dishes. But I wonder if it came down to, like, if you were there and you tried the Ballantine, you would know it was the best dish. And because I think Caroline called it one of the best, or Caroline called it one of the best dishes of the competition, which I think shows that, like, granted, the season's still young, it's a bit nubile crawling along, but the fact that Brian was able to produce such a mastery of technique. And I loved in this idea of speaking about this dish as a microcosm of the preparatory work that they put in. You know, Adrian made sure to emphasize maximum prep work, but, like, minimize execution time. And the idea of using sunchokes, which they talked about, like, really was a prominent flavor there. I believe sunchokes is, like, one of the easiest vegetables to cook in general, so much so that you can even just leave the skin on and prepare it however way you like. So I think it was just a great idea on Brian's part to maybe concentrate more on the actual preparation of the Ballantine itself, and less so on, you know, throw some stuff in there that you know you can use and not have to worry about, unlike someone like Pablo, all the components working together.
Yeah, and we saw Third Coast struggling with their comprehension of how to, I mean, they were like, oh, we're going to make an ice cream right there. We're going to shuckle oysters right there. Like, their menu did not seem to be designed with that in mind. So you do see how that pays off with Northeast for sure, whether that's in the detail of the sunchoke or otherwise. With the Ballantine, a lot of the prep work was already, most of the prep work on the thing was done already. And then it was just a matter of quickly preparing it and getting it plated. So that makes a lot of sense. And it does, like you're saying, speak to the good things about what Northeast did from the jump, putting egos aside. I do laugh because if you go back and watch the first episode, Eric is pushing for Eddie to be executive chef. And I do feel like we were denied the reality where that happens. I don't know if Northeast would have ended up the same. They may well have. They may all have stepped up in different ways. But that's a much different episode with Eddie as the executive chef in that restaurant. And I do feel like we maybe missed out a little bit.
Yeah, but I don't think we have the happy ending, you know?
Yeah, no, I don't know if I, as much as I love good TV, I don't know if I want to see someone have a panic attack over the course of two episodes while they're working through executive show. I think Eddie would be found, like, in a cabinet underneath a sink and would need to be, like, wheeled into judge's table to adjudicate everything.
He would be, like, in the corner of the stew room, like the end of the Blair Witch.
Just staring in the corner.
Exactly, yeah.
And then the camera drops to the side. Yeah.
I feel like we're getting cheated. Maybe we should, one of us should put this together. I feel like we're getting cheated because we don't have the reunion shows anymore. Like, this is tailor made for a reunion show montage, of all of Eddie's stress out moments, at judges table or otherwise. And we're just not going to, we need a montage of all the moments from this season, because you're right. It has become a running joke. And Padma keeps remarking on it. But we're, every time he goes up, even when he's about to win, he loses his mind. So, poor Edmund. He needs to really, his name is Edmund, by the way, not Eddie. Eddie is his nickname. I want to see more. I can't wait to see where this goes with Edmund. I'm looking forward to this.
The montage, though, would be like all, it's the same expression every time. So it'd be a very kind of, you could just cut back to the same clip. It'd be easy montage to put together is what I'm saying.
How many times does this have? This is the same face.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, let's move on as Antonio gets more formal with his naming of Eddie. We'll get more informal and move
on. His real name.
Yeah, to Thistle. So speaking of other like fun editing moments, we do have this Sarah getting the Christian Hubicki-esque time-lapse montage of her doing the introductions of basically the entire menu to the judges. Kurt, was this supposed to be, in your opinion, like negative? Was this just funny? What did you make of this one moment from Sarah's otherwise sterling front of house service?
Somewhere between those two, somewhere between negative and funny. I didn't get the impression. It's almost like we're trying to be led, like we were supposed to be led down the path that, oh, you know, some of the reason that service is taking long is that she's taking this long to explain the menu to every table. I didn't get that impression that that's what she was doing. I almost felt like she just kind of fell into a nervous trap and over explained to the most important table. But I mean, because this is it sounded like she went into the level of detail that you would normally be going into as the dishes were being served. So now they're going to have to kind of sit through that. But was it Padma who said that, you know, she nearly fell asleep during it?
I think like for them to be able to express that on television would like, if that is the true complaint that she was just like going on and on and on and on and on forever, to show that multiple times, I think would be tough. So I think that's why we probably get that montage, right? Like where it's like, it's almost like Christian Hubicki-esque when they're doing the scene of her just like repeating the thing over and over and over again. And there's just like all like the jump cutting in her explanation to Padma and the rest of the judges. I think to show that multiple times would probably be way too much.
Right. I just didn't get the impression it was something she was doing to every table.
Right. Yeah.
So this team ends up being on the losing end, but I think while the third coast might have more of a problem with service, this one I think had more of a problem with the dishes outright, and we can get a bit into that. Antonio, what dishes, for good or for bad, stood out for you when it came to judging Thistle?
I would like to hear Brandon, who seems to be a really bright guy.
Don't go there.
Ideas.
Don't go there.
I would like to hear why, what the idea with this goat cheese roulade with two kinds of corn was.
Oh, God.
It's not that I disagree with him. He clearly has more forward-thinking ideas about food than I, so I'd like to know what the concept behind the dish was, and I would be curious to try it. Similarly, I would be curious to try Sarah's soup that had candied ginger in it, and figure out what the idea with that particular component was. The annulati looked delicious.
Yes, give me that. All of that. Put it in my face.
Looks so good. Clearly a favorite of the night across all three restaurants, and rightfully so. I think this team failed mostly because Pablo did the two entrees, and both of the main entrees had issues. And that's really all it comes down to, is very important part of the meal, and the very important part of the meal had inconsistent prep, or in the case of the scallop dish, the balance of the dish is off with too much apple. Some of that does go down to the executive chef not being able to taste the dish, as we talked about, but she's immune and she probably wouldn't have gone home for it anyway. She might have, but I kind of doubt it. It just seemed like Pablo's taking on both entrees and putting himself in that position was the story we were told for why he ended up where he ended up. And maybe this is a scenario where four episodes later, if we had eight chefs, that sort of thing comes out in the wash a little bit more. There is more pushback. You are more comfortable telling a person, you can't do that. You shouldn't do that. You are more comfortable sticking your neck out as the executive chef because you know them a little better. So I think of the three teams, this is probably the one where the dynamic between the chefs is most represented in perhaps a negative way, in terms of who is willing to stick their neck out and tell somebody, don't do a thing. We saw that introduced last episode where Third Coast is driving around saying they really should listen to Brandon. We cut to Thistle and Pablo is saying, I want to do this. And Brandon's saying, maybe don't do that. And Pablo is not listening. So that was the story we were told. It certainly seemed like that presented itself with their food. The annulati did look delicious. And I'm very curious about that corn on that dessert.
You're being awfully generous saying it was two types of corn when one of the types was candy corn.
Like, it would be generous if you said two types of food, considering the inedibility of candy corn in general.
Was it candy corn or candied corn? I think those are two different things,
said,
right?
It said candy corn. So I don't know if Brandon, I mean, if Brandon had gotten something from like the post Halloween candy aisle and brought it in, I feel like that would be a bigger offense. But to your point, Antonio, maybe it was more of a technique of candying the corn, which still is a weird idea.
Yeah, it looked caramelized. Of some
no,
sort.
They're going to call it if they call it candy corn. And then it looks like it was thinly shaved. All I know is I want him off my team and I want him off my team now.
Oh, no.
Wow. Kurt turning against a bland white guy. This is a plot twist.
Well, especially since episode one, you were like beating the Kurt Brandon drum and now you're disavowing him.
Haley was saying I was beating the Eddie drum. I was just not anti Brandon. But no, candy corn. I'm sorry. No, no. Because we've talked about the importance of naming these dishes and it was labeled as candy corn. And that would immediately have turned me off. Like regardless.
Kurt,
of
Kurt, I will trade Pablo for Brandon right now.
Don't do it, Kurt. No, I don't know. Have you seen Last Chance Kitchen? I don't know about that deal.
This is a trade that I would make if I had anybody in contention, because obviously I don't watch Last Chance Kitchen.
Boy. Yeah, no. I think that I still don't understand the, I think that Brandon might be suffering a bit from this idea that he has really interesting ideas, but the execution is not necessarily working. Like, he had a good week, you know, last week, I believe, didn't have a great one this week. Outside of the goat cheese roulade with the questionable corn of many types, he made his other dessert was this soy milk custard with strawberries, cardamom, almond streusel, and lemon verbena. And I mean, I would like a bit of sweetness from my dessert personally. Even something like the Harbison cheese had some sweetness to it. I believe from what I'm looking at, the only sweetness came from those strawberries. I think
Mike, the candy corn brings sweetness too. Come
that was,
on.
That was another dish entirely, unless it's still lingering on the palate.
It is completely lingering on the palate.
Kurt is so angry about this. There's no fennel in candied corn, Kurt.
It's like number two on my list. Up there is number one is fennel. Candy corn just doesn't make the list because no one uses it as a component in a dish except for Brandon.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is fair because like when you get a lot of candy corn, you are wondering like, well, how the hell do I get rid of this? To get rid of all of the candy corn you've accumulated on Halloween on Top Chef is a dubious choice.
I can't wait until next season when Brandon comes in to host a quick fire of what to do with all this candy corn.
I think he's going to do a circus peanuts dish. Those big orange foamy circus peanuts.
Yeah, they filmed the Christmas special in May. I think they filmed this episode around Halloween. So there's just extra candy corn. I mean, it expanded that long. It transcends time and space this season.
I can't believe I didn't realize it was actual candy corn. I thought it was candied corn, like it was caramelized popcorn or something.
To be completely, you know, fair, it may have been, but it was listed as candy corn.
Brandon's branding has issues.
Yeah, exactly. It was from his parents' sweet shop.
Yeah, exactly. He did some pocket candy corn. He brought that contraband into Top Chef.
He may as well have brought in like sour blue raspberry gummies and dropped it on a plate.
And going back, like, you know, we haven't really talked much about the short rib and the travesty that the short rib seemed to have been. But finding the thistle, isn't that like lucky? Isn't it like finding like the king cake during Mardi, the baby in the king cake during Mardi Gras? It's like you're going to have like great sex for a year if you find the thistle and the short rib.
Whoa, hey now.
Take me to the thistle now.
Oh, is that why they said put this dish in front of the hot judge? Is that because they wanted Padma to purposely bite into the thistle?
They're all hot, Mike.
That's true. They are all hot, much like the dishes. So going back into the dishes proper, Sarah's, I like the idea of starting off with a soup. I don't want to be this guy. I don't want to be Samantha Semantics here. Tomato is not a vegetable. So I don't know if orienting things around a green tomato gazpacho doesn't necessarily scream veg forward, even though there is cucumber in it. I would say I totally agree that the annulati seemed like not only the standout dish of this restaurant, but in general, it just looked really great. I love the pea done multiple ways, both in the pasta itself and outside of it and the two different types of cheese. It seemed like Pablo, for all of his short rib shortcomings, did do well on the scallops. It's just, you know, he did really well with the apple puree, if you guys remember, in the very first elimination challenge, literally the only time he'd been on the top, basically. It seemed like apple did not benefit him here. It did fall far from the tree in this case, and that it just seemed way too sweet. I think the problem with this restaurant in general was that nothing seemed cohesive. I mean, say what you want to about Third Coast, but, you know, it was all veg-forward stuff, and we have, what, like, European from with the gazpacho and
corn. That's why the vegetable is in the dessert. It's vegetable-forward. There's the corn.
And then exactly, but probably for worse as a result. And then we have, we have the skewer scallops. We have a little bit of Asian with the kombu braised short rib, and then we have these random Halloween-themed desserts. So it just seemed like, while this was an interesting unifying concept, this felt a bit too disparate for me, so I could understand the loss here.
Fisprit. Cut to Michelle tasting the components of Brandon's dessert, just shoveling handfuls of candy corn in her mouth. I didn't try it together, but I tried the candy corn.
So on that note, I mean, Brandon said he was worried about Michelle last time. Of, you're a bit too quiet. Will you get louder in the kitchen? She said she would. Didn't seem like she was in particular in terms of like being that demanding voice to really get everyone in line. Do we think her, her quiet voice as well as her quiet tongue, I mean, do we feel like that contributed so much to their loss here in terms of Michelle even admitting that she didn't necessarily try all the components together, Josh?
I think that there's just, I mean, I think maybe to a degree, maybe if there's somebody who has just a little bit more of a stronger sense of vision and is able to rally the troops in a way with like sort of like the energy of Sarah, maybe, you know, somebody who, because I really did like the way that Sarah talked to the servers, to go back to Antonio's point from earlier in the podcast. Like I find me somebody to work for like Sarah. Yeah. That is who I want to work for always, is somebody who's just always going to bring in like the people on the low end of the totem pole and always just going to put an arm around their shoulder and just include them completely in the plan. And if she had been able to like be in the executive chef position and do that all the way top down and be like unified course of vision across all of the dishes, talking to the entire team, not just like the servers, but everybody on board in that same style of leadership, I feel like that would be a lights out group. So maybe that's part of it. I don't know. I think that it was also just kind of like, it was just like a total middle of the road performance from a team. I think, like, I don't think that this group did anything like massively wrong. I think that they just were just fine. And it just so happened to be a three team challenge and only one is going to win. So obviously these guys are going to get knocked a little bit.
Well, let's move on to really, I think, the main event in terms of discussion. Let's talk about Third Coast. I'm going to float something out here. In terms of historical precedents, or at least recent historical precedents, I'm going to say I think this is the worst front of house that I've ever seen in Restaurant Wars. This just seemed hellacious on so many levels. And we can talk about sort of who gets the blame there. But Kurt, what did you think about the depiction of a Third Coast just cacophony of front of house?
Well, obviously, it was the poor Kentucky servers. I mean, they just can't provide servers.
I can drive to Chicago.
it was interesting is that you had, I think, you know, going back to Northeast, I had a little bit of worry with Northeast and Brian at the onset, because it seemed like he was going to potentially neglect his Ballantine by needing to spend so much time with front of house. We saw there was a good balance there at the very end, and the team chipped in with the Ballantine and he spent the time with front of house. But here I had the opposite concern. It seemed like Nini was much more concerned with her dishes and getting the spoons polished than in, you know, training the front of house as they should be. It almost seemed like she ended up in that position and just thought that things would potentially come together, and they didn't. I don't know. Like, it was during that service you saw. I think they felt a little bit rudderless. Didn't quite know what to do, and like Nini having to tell them, "Well, check to see if they need food." Run if they were just standing around, like they were asking, like, "What should we do?" And they just didn't know. But you also had, you know, Nini wasn't really, you know, sure what the wine was that was being served. So I don't know. It was just, I don't know. It was the hot tub curse, I guess. You know, never plan for restaurant wars while drinking in a hot tub.
Yeah, I would say hammock is to Survivor as hot tub is to Top Chef, it seems.
Yeah, and you saw it. And this is where in my notes I have it was a Carolyn Stein, Styne, and you know, saying, you know, when she's being asked what is the potentially the most crucial thing that could get overlooked in something like this challenge or in opening a new restaurant. And she raises it, you know, not training is one of the biggest, not just one of the biggest, but I thought it was interesting. She said it's one of the easiest mistakes that a team could make or that an individual could make, not having the proper training. And then, you know, that just immediately kind of sealed the nail in the coffin for me in terms of, you know, Nene was probably not long for this world or this episode.
I mean, it was a really, really bad look when David had to come out of the kitchen to look into the dining room to see what the hell was going on. And I think to your point, Antonio, we can certainly speak as to how the communication between Justin and Nene was just bad on both levels. But when one of your chefs has to actually leave their position to see all the mayhem that's going on between, you know, wrong food being brought to the wrong tables. You know, you had this one like table 33 was eating their appetizers while their entrees were being fired and Kelsey was working on their desserts at the same time. And then there was this giant line, Black Friday-esque line, at the host stand just waiting to be seated. It really did seem like the perfect storm. The only comparable thing I can think of is we talked about Philip with the Bangkok Dangerous. You could say maybe Stefan in Top Chef Seattle, where I believe he was like yelling at his servers at one point, might be on Mount Rushmore there, but for my money, for my Eddie money, I think this might be the worst that I've seen in quite some time.
It wasn't great. And
not great,
Bob. Yeah. The fact of the matter is I thought from the way that how ungreat it was, that what I saw in the episode made me think that Justin and Nene should have gone home, not Nene and Pablo. I definitely thought Nene should go home, and it's unfortunate. It wasn't entirely her fault in terms of the way the thing was planned, in terms of the way the blueprint people didn't have the joint finished when she was ready to go, and the way the menu itself was being executed at the time. But I felt like the exec and front of house should have gone home in that situation, especially because what we saw from Adrian, for example, is when her servers at the beginning of service are getting tickets incorrect, she steps up and starts correcting it. And we heard the judges discuss this, that Justin could have stepped up, that he didn't just have to say, like, there was a disaster in the front of house and we screwed it up. It's the communication between the front and the back that's the problem. If the front's not stepping up to fix that, the back is the buck stops here. They're the last person responsible for what could get fixed there. I know they were in the weeds. I know they were trying to get food out. I know they had attendant problems with their own individual dishes. I'm sure that Justin's dish suffered as a result of what was happening with the service. Although in confessional, which of course was probably filmed after, he said he thought it tasted good. And the taste of his dish was a huge part of the problem, along with the fact that it was too thick, which he did admit he thought might be the case. So I'm sure his dish suffered as a result of that. He did not put out a good dish. The exec is the buck stops here, like I said. So I really thought he should have gone home probably too, along with Nene. But if they were just going to go with the bottom two teams, send one person from each, it makes sense.
Had they specified that too? So like Tom rolled in and he goes, two teams are going to, you know, two people are going to go. Like if that wasn't the rule where it was like automatically what the lowest person on each team is going to go. So, you know, it's going to be split across two teams. Then I totally agree with you, Antonio. I think that Justin should have gone instead of Pablo.
I wonder if it was just a matter of, you know, do you pref someone cooking one bad dish and not running exec versus someone who cooked two bad dishes? I wonder if Pablo had done just at least a little bit better. You know, if he had pulled off one dish rather than zero, if he would have stayed and maybe Justin would have gone, which would have been an interesting storyline as well if they faced off against each other in LCK as well.
Well, and keep in mind, we're seeing an edit, right? So we are seeing an edit that tells the story of what happened bad with that team. I mean, Michelle was talking about, she was saying, I'm having a really hard time getting food to the right table when Thistle was doing service. We just didn't really see any kind of train wreck in that regard. And we didn't really see any issues with Northeast either, although I'm sure they had them. We saw maybe one instance where half of a dish went out and Brian is following the server to the table. Otherwise, we saw Adrian really stepping up and correcting wrecked, and we just didn't seem to see any kind of plagued issues. But this one seemed particularly poor. People waiting over an hour for the reservation. We've seen problems with turning tables in the past, but that's different because people are having a good time and they're sitting around and drinking instead of moving on. This was people not even getting to the table or not getting their food or food going to the wrong table or refiring food. It was bad.
Yeah, so I think they because there was that one point where Padma was asking Nini,
when's your last reservation?
So that 10:15 reservation had to wait an hour. Nini's like, yeah, and this is our first case of classic Padma side eye. There was just that pause, and it's like, okay, thank you. Yeah. I mean, you could tell that if that did not raise an alarm in Nini's head that the judges were not impressed with the front of house service, there was no hope that it was going to get through.
Yeah. I mean, it did. She went back to the kitchen and told Kelsey, they said they're not happy. And it's like, well, what are we going to do? Like the horse is out of the barn at that point. I mean, at that point, the barn's on fire and there's no real thing they could do. So
it was like 11:30 at night.
Yeah, it's bad. I feel like there's an opportunity there for one of those people in the back to step up and say, like, I'll be the adult in the room. We're going to get this done. And I didn't see that on the show. I'm not saying it didn't happen or the attempts weren't made. But in my mind, that person whose role that should be is the role that Justin was occupying. And I didn't see that sort of leadership emerging. What I saw was a lot of combative, probably fueled by the scenario that he described as the worst of his career, negativity and negative energy and fighting and accusing Nini of walking tickets around when she didn't. And he is the ones who had placed it there. And David's going to the front of the house and Kelsey's yelling at the servers. Like, somebody needed to step up in the void that was created by Nini's failure to step up. And the fact that he didn't, I think that in my mind should have sent him home as well. But I'm glad that he's still here. We'll see how it goes. And we'll see how it goes with Nini as well. TBD.
Well, speaking of sort of stepping up to maybe take over for some shortcomings, I do want to speak about this brief thing that happens with Nini's dessert. And we can talk about the final product, but there is a point where early on in the service, when dishes are actually coming out on time, in the kitchen, these guys are trying to spin their ice cream because Nini doesn't have an opportunity and realize that the ice cream has basically turned into soup. And it's not hard enough to really make, a cohesive dish. So Justin suggests, let's just forgo it. It doesn't say ice cream on the menu. It only says chocolate in ironic quotations. Let's just go with that. Nini sees that come out and not wanting to, pull what happened to Carrie Ann, where Katsuji made an executive decision to sort of, cover for her dessert in season 12, and she ends up going home because of it. She goes back there and, tries to solve the situation. That's where she sort of starts perpetuating this idea that it really feels like front house versus back of house. Josh, did you have any sort of feelings about the way Nini and, from another perspective, the other three chefs were handling this dessert situation?
I think my biggest one is, if you're going to be front of house, don't make ice cream.
Yeah.
That's a big mistake. Like, if you're going to be front of house, then the dish that you should be making is something that you're really not going to have to worry about. Something that's a little bit dummy proof. Yeah, you want it to be clever. You want it to be memorable, but something that's a little bit dummy proof. And ice cream, at the very least, is like the full opposite of that. Like, anything that has a risk of, like, you're going to need to churn it during service when you are front of house is a big no-no.
Yeah. And I think what the discussion was, like, there's this chunk of the ice cream that was like just too, soupy and melty, but then there's outer part that was like just too hard to serve. Like, I don't know, was there not a Goldilocks section of the ice cream that was just right that you could end up serving? But I'm glad you raised that point, Mike, because I had my notes a question on whether or not ice cream was actually called out specifically in the menu. Like, I couldn't remember. I think you just kind of have to like let the people that are plating your dish, like, make that call. But it seems like ultimately the issue was that Padma pointed out, if you're a chocoholic, this is not going to satisfy you. So I just don't think that, even if everything had turned out right with the ice cream, that it would still have been a winning dish and that wouldn't have solved all the woes with front of house.
I think I can officially declare the curse of the cocoa nib, because Nini had this sort of like, her quote unquote chocolate was, she did have a chocolate crumble and a chocolate ganache, but her main component was this sort of like cocoa nib sorbet that looked like white chocolate, but actually tasted like dark chocolate. And if we remember during the dessert challenge, Brian nearly went home because he pickled cocoa nibs and it came across as really acidic as a result. So this might need to be, I know it feels like every season of Top Chef, we have like a cursed ingredient or a cursed dish. People might want to be staying away from cocoa nibs from now on.
And anything involving brine, which includes pickling, apparently. There's kind of like this Venn diagram now of things you do not do this season.
Can I speak real quick about Nene? Because I have a question for you guys. So you, Mike, pointed out Kelsey's exaggeration. You didn't call it that, but I will. Because she said the center was liquid, and I was looking at it, didn't look like liquid. And she said the edges were completely hard, and I looked at it and didn't look like that. So I'm throwing a little shade at Kelsey here, because she said she didn't have time, and I get that, or didn't want to, which I think maybe is also part of it, spin more liquid nitrogen into the ice cream during service. And yet, when the judges were served that dish, it had ice cream on it. So what the hell happened? Is that what ultimately ended up happening? Did Kelsey go back and put more liquid nitrogen in the ice cream after Nene put her foot down? Is that what happened? I didn't see how we threaded that needle. We went from ice cream is unservable to ice cream is servable. And the judges had no comment about the texture or problems with the sorbet. Their issue was the composition of the dish, which Nene owned. Kelsey wanted to step up, reverse shade here. She tried to claim that it was her responsibility and that Nene shouldn't be dinged for that. And good for her for standing up in that way. Nene said, that's how I wanted it plated. So the issues with the dish were not Kelsey's fault, but I'm wondering what the hell happened. The ice cream went from unservable to servable. Kelsey didn't seem to think that that could happen, and yet it did. So what happened? Does anybody have any idea? Am I missing something here?
I was watching the Canadian edit. I assumed you guys would know.
I mean, my best guess, I honestly think that when it came to Nene saying like help this and Kelsey said I couldn't, I think it was just from a lack of hands in the kitchen. I think it was because there were only three of them working on their own separate things that they didn't necessarily. One of the reasons why Nene had to serve her own ice cream is because they just didn't have time. I wonder if maybe yet another contributor to this front of house kerfuffle is that Nene, maybe she did something herself. Maybe she rolled up her sleeves and poured the liquid nitrogen in, took a second from the calamity going on in the dining room and decided to make her own ice cream. That's probably my
Somebody
best guess. I'm not entirely sure. Somebody did.
Right. And somebody did. And that probably contributed to other issues that we saw throughout the service. No doubt. Although the entrees on that team, as we're going to talk about, seemed to be pretty good. So it didn't seem to maybe hurt that. And Kelsey's dessert was great. So it didn't seem to hurt that. So I am wondering, they threw up their hands and said, this ice cream's unservable. And we have to change her dish. She comes back to the kitchen, says, I need my ice cream on there. We don't see how that gets fixed. And yet it got fixed somehow. So again, I'm pointing this out because there's something in the edit here, obviously, that is made to create the drama and made to show all the insanity. We're not actually seeing, I think, the down moments where things are fixable or things are normal, because the story we're being told of this team is that it's going off the rails. And so I don't know what exactly was done to fix that, but I want to point out that there is a slip there where it's unservable. And then all of a sudden it's served to the judges and they have no complaints about the sorbet or the texture of the sorbet. It's fine for them. And that they came late in the service. So I really don't know what happened there, but it was fixed at some point.
So yeah, let's get into the sort of third coast dish, because I'll admit, while the team was going down in flames, I got a bit worried for David and Kelsey, who I think might be two of my favorite contestants that are on the show right now. But it seemed like both of them did really well. You know, David, even though Third Coast did quote unquote team dishes with the oysters and the punch our train, David really contributed to the latter in terms of the protein. He got commendations for that. For the duck, even though they felt like it wasn't necessarily cohesive with the rest of it. And Kelsey, once again, knocking it out of the park with that dessert. I loved the panna cotta, just the plating of it, just it being in that little skillet. I thought it was just a really, I don't know, if you're going for this homey feel of the dishes on the walls of Forrest Gump's mom's house, this felt the most homey.
I love panna cotta so much, and I wanted to eat that panna cotta.
It looked so good.
It looked really, 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 really super good. It looked great. Yes, if Emily Fox were on this podcast right now, I'm sure she would be too much of a champion to be bragging about the incredible panna cotta she made during the Christmas season this past year. But let me just be here and say, Emily Fox, make the mean panna cotta.
I love it. Kurt, any highlights or lowlights for you from Third Coast, aside from what we've talked about?
Not really, to be completely honest. There was nothing here that leapt off the plate, which would actually be, you know, I'd be, you know, horrified if something actually literally left
off the
plate.
It is third coast and there's a lot of seafood, yeah. So it wouldn't be surprising.
It's, you know,
I'd be intrigued.
Yeah, I'd be intrigued. Like, you know, underreported is actually my love of blackberries is one of my favorite fruits. So between Adrian's cheese dish.
Underreported.
Yes.
That needs to get more attention, I think, just widespread how much Kurt likes blackberries.
Our news sites are too dedicated to the, like, the intangible, you know, frivolous issues. We need more stuff about Kurt's love of blackberry.
The fact that I said it, I think now means it's been reported exactly enough. But you know, Adrian incorporating it into her cheese dish for Northeast, and now Kelsey including it in her dessert for Third Coast. This is something I was also intrigued by. I do like a good bisque. I don't know if this was a good bisque. I would have liked to have tried that, assuming everything had gone according to plan. But yeah, otherwise, there's nothing really that intrigued me a whole lot about the dishes other than maybe the dessert here.
The oysters really intrigued me because all they were described as was char-grilled Chesapeake Bay oysters with compound butter. But it seemed like there was so much stuff on there, including like this entire, like, I don't know, purple vegetable. Maybe it was cabbage or something that they were lying on top of. I don't know if that was a component of the dish, but it seemed like a relatively simple description for something that was very complicated, which I don't know, maybe the description is more apt considering that I think a diner said it was lacking something.
Kelsey calls them oysters, by the way. I want to point that out for anyone who didn't notice. The oysters in this case were huge. I mean, I didn't know what we were looking at. Like, those are giant. Yeah, it was plated on some sort of loamy, sandy, like, vegetable thing that I don't think was part of the dish. I think it was just part of the presentation. How could it be lacking something when the judges were like, there's Worcestershire sauce here, there's hot sauce here, there's all sorts of acid. They called it an acid bomb.
How many chef tests does it take to make a compound butter? Apparently all of them had a hand in it.
All of them had a hand in it, right? So who the hell knows what was going on with that oyster dish? But yeah, they were also having issues shucking the oysters, and that's also a problem. So that dish did not do well. It did not go well, clearly. And that's, I don't think, why they lost. They lost for front of house, clearly. But that was not a great dish that was representative of, think of the food that these people on this team are capable of putting out. I think the panna cotta and the duck are much more representative. The fish dish was much more representative. So they cook good food. We expected that from this team. We certainly got some of that, but we got it at a great cost to their sanity. We're seeing a lot of these people at their worst moments for sure. And so I don't want to come across like I'm throwing too much shade at any of them. I don't think this, other than maybe David, I don't think any of them really came off looking very well from this experience. And David didn't come off looking great, but he certainly didn't take too many hits. But Kelsey got the really bad edit with the Sarah thing, where Sarah is being nice to her servers, and we cut right to Kelsey yelling at their servers. Justin got a really bad look, and certainly Nene did not look good with what was going on. So not a great look for anyone on the team, even though their food did stand out in ways.
So let's cut the judges' table here. So Northeast wins, Eddie face crack of the century, and Brian ends up winning here, which makes sense. His younger brother, Joe Flam, won last season in Restaurant Wars in front of house. So I think you got to keep it in the family. But
the Flamly.
The Flamly. But should we be worried for Brian? Because it seems like literally every person who wins an elimination challenge this season is going to go home the very next week.
I'm worried. That's my boy. I've been rooting for my goofy guy, Brian, from the beginning of the season. Very happy to see him in the ascendancy here. But yeah, the pattern is not great. Maybe he'll break the pattern. He said at the beginning of the first part, his goal now is just to win them all so he doesn't end up on the bottom again. So maybe he's going to break the pattern. But yeah, I'm worried. Sure, that's my guy. I don't want to see this happen.
Well, Josh, I know you spoke about last time you were on here during the Natalie elimination about how it does really open the door wide when a front runner goes home early as to this is really anybody's game. Now this happens for the second time with Nene, who is arguably a bigger front runner in that she won two elimination challenges in a row going home. Do we feel like this is a sort of pattern? Is there anything contributing to the way that these two sort of ended up falling so early?
No.
There we go.
There we go. Yes. And we can't really say it's complacency. It's not like they win and then get complacent because, you know, Nene had two back-to-back wins. So you know, you have enough seasons of Top Chef. This is going to be a pattern that emerges at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just more so what you guys were talking about during the second episode of, like, I think this sort of hammers home this judging mentality, especially this early on of, like, no matter how good you do, if you have a bad day, you have a bad day. And that's what happened to Nini here. She was flying high, and due to circumstances that were partially her own and maybe partially someone else's fault, she really fell really hard, to the point where we all were saying that she was going to go home last week, despite the fact that she was probably in it to win it at the point before, you know, going into episode four proper. But it just shows the variance that can come with Top Chef, and it makes it exciting, but it makes it extremely anxiety ridden. I'm getting on Eddie level here in terms of, you know, as people that I think have been doing really well so far possibly going home next week. I don't like it. We do have Last Chance Kitchen, but it makes me sad to see us kill our darlings here.
That's morbid.
somebody like Eric, who hasn't been on the top, Michelle made her way to the top this episode and talked about how she was so glad to no longer be in the middle. Maybe the key is to be like Eric and just get there, stay there in the middle, get in, stay high, do what you got to do in terms of being in the top, not on the bottom. But don't really go into the final, you know, like the people that are going to win. Just do what you're doing. Don't win. Don't stick your neck out. Maybe that's the message. So maybe Eric, in there having not won anything, he's going to be the one who finds his way through the morass that is killing your darlings, as you say, Mike. Because Adrian's now stuck her neck out as well. Like, this could be trouble. Maybe Eric is the guy ultimately who's going to survive through all of this. We'll see what happens.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Adrian, because I would actually compare that to another Adrian from last season who was pretty, you know, she finished in the bottom, I think, the first three challenges. But then outside of that, she was pretty good in terms of coasting until the very end when she turned it up and as a result was able to make it to the finale. So I feel like there is now some precedent to this idea of, like, just don't be last. It's sort of like an Amazing Race-esque mentality of, yeah, like, you can take risks, but sometimes we've seen people, Pablo included, we're going to see him go home this episode because he's consistently cooked in a manner of biting off more than he can chew, where now he's going to finish in the bottom for a third time in a row just because he tries to pursue this very audacious dish and it just doesn't live up to what he put out there. And so maybe that is sort of advocating this idea of, like, because things are so up and down in this season in particular of Top Chef, you just got to keep your head down and maintain.
I agree, Mike. You're right.
Aw, thank you.
there was a lot of that. I just want to say, I apologize for not just saying thank you. How are you, Mike, at the beginning of this show? Because you seem to appreciate when we ask how you're doing. So I just want to say you're doing a good job today.
I don't want to know.
It's good for a podcast service to sort of, like, greet you. If you treat your podcast host nicely, they'll treat you back nicely as well. Do any of you guys have any eulogizing you want to do for Nini and Pablo, despite the fact that one of them in particular, not to spoil Last Chance Kitchen, is looking very good to come back right now?
Well, that one we will talk about in a few moments, so I don't know that there's any non-spoilery elegant way of talking about one but not the other. But the one who is not in contention
Nini is primed to come back, so I guess we can eulogize Pablo fully. And I don't know if you want to, in a contingency plan, eulogize Nini. You know, dinner is yours to feast on whatever components you want.
It sucks for Pablo. I think, Antonio, I think you woke me to what the correct path for this episode should have been. I think Nini and Justin should have gone home.
Yeah.
And I think, like, Pablo, like, sure, maybe rolled out, like, some mediocre to not great entrees. But, like, were those sins greater than Justin's sins in conjunction with Nini? I don't know. I don't know that they were.
It's telling that on Restaurant or on Last Chance Kitchen, Brothers, like, they didn't send the chef home on Restaurant Wars. Like, it's rare that you send a line cook home. So it is. I mean, he did take on both entrees, and that's a thing. And the front of house was fine or good on that restaurant, and the back of house was immune. So I understand why he gets the chop. But I just felt like what happened with Third Coast and it was such. But not just that for Pablo. I don't feel like I know too much about Pablo.
Yeah.
And I could be wrong about this, but I feel like I know a lot about Nene, and maybe that's because she has a bigger story to tell the rest of this season. I feel like I know a lot about David. I know a lot about Brian. I know a lot about Sarah, but Pablo's a guy that I don't feel like I got a ton of his backstory throughout. So as far as a boot episode for Pablo, we certainly lament when we can see these things coming, when somebody gets a strong edit or content that they haven't had before, and then they go home. I just don't feel like I know Pablo that well. I don't feel like I got to know what his view on food is. I don't feel like I got to know what he does specifically that got him on Top Chef. So that's my Pablo lament, if you will, is that I just don't feel like I ever really got to know the guy the way that I feel like you often get to know chef testants. And through as many episodes as he made it, I feel like there could have been an opportunity to do some of that. All I feel like I really know about Pablo is that he's a little stubborn and he knows how he likes to do things. And he's not afraid to hold back. So that's a little bit unfortunate considering I thought the dynamic between Justin, Pablo, and Sarah when they win the first quick fire was great.
Yeah.
And I thought how they adapted on the fly spoke to maybe the abilities that they would show on this show, the ability to make decisions in the moment that would be good decisions and not bad. That kind of quick fire level competition certainly usually serves chefs well. I don't feel like I saw much of that from Pablo the rest of the season. So that is my lament, is I feel like we didn't really get to know the guy or his food very well. It's a different tale for sure, because we've had winners go home. We know them a little bit more because we see them win and we get the story of why they composed the dish a certain way or what they were going for, because Pablo wasn't really a winner in that way previously, or hadn't really just had a lot of show content. It just feels like a little bit of a negative edit. I mean, I know more about Kevin and what Kevin was doing on Top Chef and what his story is than I do about Pablo. So that's my real complaint about Pablo going home, is that I just don't feel like I got that.
But I think part of that is it feels like we should know him better because we're talking about a challenge that is typically so late in the season that it feels like we're later than we are.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. We're really only talking about the first four eliminations here still. And, at that stage of the game, Pablo is not somebody that you're typically going to know terribly well, I feel like. So I don't know.
I feel like we got more content for Kevin and when Kevin went home. That's the only thing.
I just think that there's just a funkiness to the pacing of this season. Am I on an island with that? Like this season feels weird and sort of unpleasant. It just doesn't feel, it feels like there were some attempts in the back of house to turn this season into something that's just a little bit more different and a little bit more surprising structurally. And I think that it's a misfire so far. I think this whole episode, this two-parter is very emblematic of a lot of the issues that I've been having with Kentucky so far, not the state, Antonio.
Thank you.
And regarding the island that is this season, I think you're more of a man of science, Josh, and I'm more of a, and I'm more of a man of faith when it comes to where this is going. And I've not been like I sit back and look at my experience with the season, and it's like I haven't been not enjoying it, and I'd say I have been enjoying it at times. It's not sticking out to me.
A glowing review of Top Chef Kentucky. I haven't been not enjoying it.
Well, you know me. I don't tend to enjoy things. So me not getting
besides
excited.
Besides blackberries, it's underreported.
Yes. So it's like I tend not to get excited or over enjoy particular seasons. And so this feels like a pretty standard season to me. It hasn't been standing out as being unfavorable in any real way. So
I point Josh, you to Daniel Feinberg, who was tweeting about this week and his love of Top Chef and why he feels like it's still delivering in season 16 and what he likes about this season. He had an extended Twitter conversation about it. So maybe see what you think about that. I'm not saying I stand for that one way or the other, but it is a conversation that's out there and that people are having. Mike, where are you on it? I'm curious because I don't know that we've heard that from you and you're more, deeply involved in the coverage of this season. I don't know what you may have that lends any insight or changes your view of what we're seeing so far in season 16.
So what I will say is, from a cast perspective, I think they're a good group. I do wonder if from an editing perspective, because you have big contenders like Natalie and Nene going home so early, that contributed to the loss of airtime from other people. Like, I still feel like Eric and Michelle alike are just two big gaping holes of characterization in terms of what we really know about them. And they definitely stand out. Everyone else, I feel like, at least has a couple of quirks that I know them very well. I don't feel like there's any big standout kooky personalities that immediately, you know, hook myself into them. I already talked about how my two favorites probably are David and Kelsey right now, just because I think they're both fun and have enough of a personality and some cooking to boot that I think, you know, hopefully make them in for the long haul. I think the challenges, admittedly, are, I don't want to use the term uninspired. I just think they're very interesting. And then they're also indicative of the fact that, like, I do acknowledge this is a show that is 16 seasons in. You don't want to keep repeating the same thing over and over and over again. That's actually why I do admire the effort to genuinely surprise the chefs for Restaurant Wars, make it early, make it three teams. I just don't know if the execution necessarily matched up to the conception, as what happened with a few dishes in this episode. But I feel like the other stuff, Antonio, you sort of talked about how we were losing the plot a bit with Kentucky. We'll see next week. It appears we're going, as we're nearing the 2020s, we're going back to the 1920s next week, doing a bit of like a Gatsby party speakeasy type of thing. My hope is that we bring stuff back to the Kentucky of it all, because I do feel like maybe one of the strongest episodes overall was episode 2, when they have this big Kentuckian feast and have to basically cook based on that meal. I do feel like the strength of the challenges is based very primarily on the tie back to the culture of the location where they're at. Otherwise, you could just put them up on a soundstage and have them cook, you know, whatever you want to every week. So that's what I'm hopeful for. So I am keeping my hopes up, because I do agree. I think that the start has been interesting. It's been a bit chaotic to see Natalie and Nene eliminated so quickly. It really means that, like, you know, one day you're in and the next day you're out, to quote a show that's comparable to Top Chef. But I will say, in terms of like start so far, it has not been as fiery as other seasons in recent memory for me.
Yeah, and we'll see. I feel like the Kentucky part is a huge part of this. I just don't feel like we're getting an identity. I can't say one way or the other on the chef test, since I think that's a good point about when you've got these big contenders or winners going home quickly, that does change the dynamic of an early season. It just feels differently as a normal than a normal Top Chef season in terms of the structure. For that reason, the Christmas challenge followed by the two-part Restaurant Wars. I mean, we're talking about now half our season has been diverted from the normal Top Chef structure in the what we would see through six episodes now. So it is a little bit jarring in that regard. Last Chance Kitchen is going to change that next week too, it looks like. It certainly is going to be another jarring moment throughout the season. It's going to change the way I think the quick fire operates on the first portion of this next episode. So maybe once that gets over and done with, this season will hit the ground and really start to roll.
And I will say, in terms of not really knowing much about Pablo, the one thing that I took down is that Pablo said he wasn't planning on having children anytime soon, but he's pretty sure he was unplanned from his respective parents. So that's a good way to go out for Pablo.
Yeah. So here's to Pablo, the unplanned child, for sure.
Well, let's move into something that is more planned. Let's talk about Last Chance Kitchen. Apologies, Josh. I don't know if you want to put on the podcast earmuffs for this one, which I guess is ironically taking off your headphones. But
you know my feelings on the matter. I will not relitigate.
Well, let's get into, because this is we got a bit of a heft. Just like we had a two part Restaurant Wars, we had a two part Last Chance Kitchen this week, because this is sort of like our mid season buyback, as it were. Just like last season, they are bringing one person back into the competition. Kurt, talk us through exactly what these two-part Last Chance Kitchen episodes consisted of.
So this one was almost a deconstructed Restaurant Wars, to use a term often brought up in Top Chef. So they had to come up with a concept for a restaurant and then, you know, provide the dish that was kind of the headliner that brings that concept to life. Or if you are Natalie, come up with the dish and then reverse engineer the concept, which I don't think is a bad idea at all, but I'm jumping ahead. So each chef in Last Chance Kitchen had to develop a restaurant concept and then a dish that brought that concept to life.
Mm-hmm. I actually really like this idea. I think we said that LCK is at its strongest when it bases challenges off the things that sent people home. And I can't think of a better way to do it than, this type of challenge. It actually reminds me of Top Chef California, the challenge that sent Kwame home, which is basically for them to sort of come up with their own branded restaurant and cook something that's representative of it. We did not get a reprise of Taco Dudes that eventual winner Jeremy touted out there. But Antonio, what did you think about this concept?
I like it. I like the connection between the show, and I always like when we've got, I don't like it when we foist some sort of sponsor or not connected to the episode thing into Last Chance Kitchen. I prefer it when it is some way connected to the elimination of the chef. It makes me feel like Last Chance Kitchen is more alive and more connected to the show than when they just throw up a random challenge that doesn't feel connected to what we just saw in the episode. So I like the idea. I don't feel like the initial execution was good on the first half of Restaurant Wars. Thought it really started to find its sea legs and come into being on the second part of Restaurant Wars, where we actually got to see the expanded concepts a little bit more and see more of what that looked like. That it really worked for me when we limited it to two. I feel like, for example, Natalie was just sort of BSing her way through it. And that doesn't stand out in the way that sort of what Nini is doing, or even then what Brother ends up doing when they're asked to expand. So I think we saw very different versions of this. I think Pablo also BSing his way through it a little bit and trying to just do what he wanted to do, which was do another dish that maybe spoke to how he'd fix the issues that he had in Restaurant Wars. So I think that it's hit and miss in that regard. But I enjoyed it. And I think when you've got four people, you're probably going to do something. And especially when you're introducing, like, this is what we're going to have that brings somebody back, I think you need to go big like that for sure.
Let's talk about the Brother, I'll put controversy in chocolate-esque quotes here, where, you know, you're talking about bringing in a concept for a restaurant and a signature dish. Brother has a restaurant. In fact, I believe he was the one who had missed his restaurant's opening to come out to Colorado last season. So he said, I'm just going to work with what's been successful, and I'm just going to, you know, pull out a dish that I know is going to work, this jalapeno, the tempura jalapeno popper, and I'm going to tout it out there because I want to work with something I can rely on. He gets a bit of shade from the other chef testants about not necessarily being innovative. Kurt, do you have any thoughts about Brother's strategy here?
I thought it was a weak entrant, a weak way to kind of make an impression. But you know, he is, I'm happy that there was the part two to this challenge where he then does get challenged to improve upon it and expand upon it. Now, you know, how many of these, you know, three dishes he's presenting for part two are part and parcel to, you know, things he's already done before? I don't know. I have more issue with the chef drafting as helper chefs, I guess, you know, sous chefs. But we can talk about that a bit more later. I regarding the tempura jalapeno popper, you know, he got, I guess, the fair critique that it was much, you know, much more Southwestern than Japanese, and he was going for more of a fusion of the two. But, you know, I didn't necessarily get the impression when Nini first brought it up that she felt that he was kind of taking an easy way out. I thought it was more like he has this, you know, bag of tricks he can dip into, but definitely you got some shade felt big being thrown from the peanut gallery.
Yeah, and I mean, I personally don't have a problem with it. I don't see what the difference is between this and someone saying, oh, I have a dish I make in my restaurant, or a previous contestant saying, oh, I had this dish that I was never able to make. You know, it's not too dissimilar in that, like, if you have dishes to pull from, you can do it as long as it fits the constraints of the challenge. You know, if Brooke was making that radish dessert for a giant meat buffet, yeah, that wouldn't make much sense, but I feel like, I think it's fine for Brother to do this.
And the fact, it seemed like Nini was aware that this was a dish that Brother has made before. And odds are then that Tom is aware that this is a dish that you know, Brother has made before.
Yeah, I think Brother told Tom that. He said, it's been on my menu for 5 years. And this is just a good way to stay in the middle. I think it's a good way to not end up on the bottom. Do something you know how to do. Do it well. And just let everybody else hang themselves and just walk away from it. So I think that's ultimately what happened. He was just trying to stay in the middle there.
And this isn't even a requirement, but the fact that the judge of the competition is aware that this is the case and judges accordingly, then I have no issue with it.
So let's talk about this. So Natalie's Natalie's maybe a bit contrived restaurant is NQM, Not Quite Mom's, which I guess is like, the airport code for it. She makes pan-seared scallops with braised Napa cabbage, carrot, asparagus, and mushroom broth. And Pablo is the other one who's eliminated. His restaurant is called Campo, which means field. Pan-seared carrots with herb yogurt and pickled carrots. Basically, they go home because for Pablo, there's lots of acid there between the pickled carrots and the yogurt. And
the window pane.
Exactly. Yeah, there's not enough carrot in there. For Natalie, the scallops were beautifully cooked, even though she was worried about her pan possibly not being hot enough. But all that vegetable that she put in there basically got lost. We had talked about how we felt like Natalie was going to be the one coming back unless Nini came back, was the one going to LCK. Are we surprised that we didn't get a Natalie versus Nini showdown in the finale here?
I'm not super surprised. I'm curious, Josh. I know you don't watch and you don't support, but if I told you one of Nini, Natalie, brother, and Pablo is going to come back, do you have a preference or do you have an idea of what you think would happen?
No, this is the only thing that I can weigh in on, though, because I'm not watching Last Chance Kitchen, as I'm sure will come as no surprise. So what's going to happen is, so it's brother versus Nini, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
One of them is coming back in. So what's going to happen here is either Nini is going to come back in and the last 2 weeks of Top Chef were partially for nothing.
BB rewind.
Yeah. You know, Pablo is gone. That's permanent. But Nini just comes right back in the very next week. Or brother luck is just going to like airdrop into the middle of Top Chef Kentucky. And that's a guy who stands a really good chance of riding this thing all the way to the end. And this is somebody who has been completely absent from the first 5 episodes of Top Chef Kentucky. So I don't love either option. I'm not thrilled with either option. So, yeah, we could go off on another 45-minute tangent about why, but just flat out baseline, those are my feelings.
Yeah, I don't want mommy and daddy fighting again on the podcast, please.
My feelings on LCK have not moved one way or the other.
So I will admit that I think on paper, again, I was a bit surprised to see Natalie go here, though I think the reasons why she went and why brother and Nini ended up staying make sense. And I don't know, maybe I was just hopeful because Natalie was such a front runner from episode one to you know, have her come back and really show that she can do it. But maybe this just didn't seem like her challenge. She seemed to even admit to that. And I feel like she had at least a pretty good run, at least from her own confidence perspective. She was someone who spent nearly a year out of the kitchen. And now she's able to say, okay, I think I can do this. I'm ready to come back. So even though we won't see her back on our screens, on the main show proper, I'm happy to have at least seen more of Natalie on LCK, even if the circumstances of episode 2 did end in an early exit. And, you know, Pablo tried to sort of redeem himself here. It didn't end up turning out too well, but from what I talked about with him in my exit interview with him, and this speaks towards, I think, what you were saying before, Antonio, about just how he seems to be a big risk-taking person, and I think that just comes from his personality. He said to me multiple times that I'd rather go home for something that I felt good with and took a risk on rather than staying because I played it safe. And that just depends on the chef testing. But I guess from that perspective, he went home on his own rules.
He did. Although, I mean, he made a carrot, right? So like, I don't know. I know that it is something maybe different than making a jalapeno popper, but it's also not super complicated. So I don't know exactly where to draw the line with Pablo. I liked him from the jump, and I'm sad to see him go, but I'm not surprised. As far as Natalie goes, I think you're right that her story seems to be somebody who hadn't been in the kitchen in a while. Getting back means inconsistency. It means that she maybe is not able to find the rhythms that she found, even though she's going to find high highs and do well. It also might mean that she bottoms out a couple times. And in this particular instance, we definitely saw that. So kudos to both of them. I like that, at least in Natalie's case, I got to learn a little bit more about what she was doing, see more of her food, because she definitely did not go home in a way that felt fair to me. So I'm glad she got the opportunity to cook a little more and show her personality. It's unfortunate that she won't be able to come back in the competition. I would have liked to have seen a Natalie versus Nini scenario for the final here. But as far as it goes, I definitely understand why we end up where we end up. The thing about Brothers Jalapeno Popper was it was good. Whether or not it was perfect or whether or not it is something that he's done before, it was good. Tom liked it. So here we are.
So the second half we have here, as mentioned before, basically Brother and Nini, to enter back into the competition or enter the competition in Brother's case, they have to essentially take this one dish they made and expand it into a fully realized 3-course meal. But don't worry, they have some help. They randomly draw knives because I think it would be pretty unfair for Brother to just pick people based on names of the remaining 10 chef testants to work with them. There's a smidge of drama with both Nini picking Justin, but Justin seemed to totally, and from his perspective, say that would just happen to be the day of, you know, I'm still supporting Nini. And then Kelsey possibly thinking about throwing things because she's on Brother's team, but decides to let her competition sort of take over and decide not to. But Kurt, what did you think about the way this second half of the episode was implemented with drafting the current chef testants to serve as sous chefs for our Last Chance Kitchen contenders?
I want to think the best of the chefs, but I just don't think that this is necessarily fair to Brother. You have many of the chefs, like pretty much all the chefs on Nini's side are saying, we're going to get you back. You know, this, and we want you back in the competition. And just from following many of these chefs on social media and Instagram, is like, you can see, regardless of, you know, how entertaining an individual may think the season is, these people seem to have grown very close, and like lots of people have found like a second family in this cast. And so I think, I don't know. And again, I maybe just keyed into looking for drama and looking for conflict. I especially know how close that Kelsey and Nini are. It seems odd to put, you know, someone's closest friend on the opposite team. Like it's, but, you know, the integrity, I guess we have to just expect it to shine through. It just seems like this is going to be an uphill battle for Brother, having people who want Nini back in the competition on his team. And I can pretty much guarantee that's probably everybody on Brother's team would also rather have Nini back than Brother.
And I think that may be something that I think production maybe acknowledged that as well. And I think that's why they introduced the incentive, which for Josh and maybe the uninitiated, the 5 sous chefs that cook with the chef who ends up returning from LCK get an advantage in the next elimination challenge. And I don't know what that means, but I guess that's the incentive that they're trying to create, because they're throwing out money in every other challenge, but they couldn't necessarily do it here. And Toto, do you have any thoughts about the way that they structured this final challenge?
It's difficult. Everything Kurt said is right. Like, what are you going to do?
Thank you, Antonio.
I think, underreported is how much I often agree with Kurt.
You also love blackberries.
Yes. I love all berries. Somebody told me there's something that's a berry that I didn't realize was a berry. Is it an eggplant?
Schnozberry. That's the schnozberry.
No, I think it's an eggplant. Is that right? An eggplant is a berry. Am I wrong about this? Yeah. I don't know.
Interesting.
Fact check me somebody on that, but I think that somebody said an eggplant was a berry, or an aubergine, I guess maybe some others in the audience might call it, but I think it's a berry. I could be wrong about that. So my mind got expanded on berries. Maybe it was the window pane. I will say ultimately that Brother is definitely up against it. And he should be, really. I mean, he should be, because look, yeah, everything Josh says about a chef who hasn't been in the season is true in terms of, like, we're going to be airdropping Brother Luck into the season. I disagree about his ability to run the table, but that's another matter entirely. He's going to be airdropped into a scenario where he is not knowing anyone. So he's up against it, and it's difficult, but it should be difficult because he's a vet. And so he has advantages that Nini doesn't have. So it feels like this balances the playing field a little bit. I think a fun part of this that's a little bit underreported, I know you guys mentioned it, which is that Kelsey sort of, Mike, as you're saying, has the confessional where she says, like, I thought I could maybe screw this up and get Nini back in the house, and that would be fine. She's getting a little bit of a villain edit. In Top Chef, we see these sometimes. We start last episode, first part of Restaurant Wars, with the funny scene of when she's got biscuits in the oven and Brandon pulls them out, and no one wants to take responsibility for this because everyone is afraid of Kelsey. And then we see her yelling at the servers, and the way that it's edited is presented very clearly as a contrast between her and and Kelsey. So I think Kelsey's getting a little bit of a villain edit. Maybe that's just because she's feisty and she's willing to give them the content that they can use in that way.
You're just mad that she yelled at the Kentucky servers. That's what's going on here.
I think I'm just mad because she reminds me of Tammy Lauren. So that is part of it. But I'm also mad about the Kentucky servers. I know I want to give Kelsey credit for standing up for NeNe at the judges table and for cooking incredible food that I want to eat. I just think it's fun that she's the one that the judge, that the editor seem to be finding a way to get the feisty confessionals from. Maybe some of the other the chef testants aren't willing to step up and throw that shade that she's willing to throw. So I'm not surprising she was the one, including the fact that she's friends with NeNe. I am a little surprised by how Justin is handling this. I feel like he feels like he has to compensate for something. So he's being overly helpful to NeNe and really being a team player here and saying he has no hard feelings, considering we heard NeNe in confessional say that Justin maybe should have been a little more responsible for what happened. And we see the other chef testants, including the eliminated people, saying he's the one who threw her under the bus. Yeah. So that's the narrative that's out there. So I thought his dynamic was just as interesting as the dynamic of anyone that was on Brothers team, for sure.
Well, and I wonder if that's editing, though, because we got so many cuts of Justin being like, NeNe, try the shrimp. NeNe, do you want the tails on the shrimp? And I feel like everyone was doing that, but for some reason, maybe they're accentuating it because that's the most dramatic part. By the way, livescience.com says that to botanists, a berry is a fleshy fruit that has multiple seeds on the inside, embedded in the flesh of the ovary, such as a blueberry. Strangely to us, that makes all these other things berries to botanists. Tomatoes, eggplants, grapes, persimmons, and chili peppers.
And it excludes certain fruits commonly called berries, such as strawberries and raspberries.
Wow. So a berry, a strawberry isn't really a berry then.
That's according to...
So is it just a straw?
I'm out on this. I hear Laurel, you're all crazy.
Oh no, what did Grover say?
Yeah.
He did not say that calling strawberries not berries was an effing excellent idea. I promise you that.
Well, let's finish things off here. And Josh, you can maybe couch this in just general thoughts, and the rest of us can sort of think about, you know, the first two courses. We don't see all three courses served. They want to build some hype for the episode proper. But based on both their body of work and what they put out in LCK so far, I want to go around the horn, and I want each of you to pick A, who you think is going to win out of NeNe and Brother, and B, to the discussion you guys were having before, how far you think they're going to go in the competition. The only other time this has happened was with Leanne and Claudette last season. Leanne, due to extenuating circumstances, went right back out. Claudette made it a couple of rounds, but then went out in Restaurant Wars, so didn't make it that far. I do wonder if our next mid-season returnee is going to have a similar sort of revolving door. Kurt, let's start with you. Who's winning and how far are they going to make it?
In a surprise twist, both just like last season, both of them come back in the competition, and then they actually both go out at 5 and 6 concurrently, with NeNe going out at 6 and Brother going out at 5.
Okay, wow. Really mapping out a storybook-like ending for NeNe and Brother. Their fates are tied together since the very beginning here.
If I have gun to head, if I have to choose just one, I would say that NeNe comes back.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think she's going to do now that she's... Would you say
then that... She would go out at 6th.
Okay. Antonio, what are you thinking?
Well, I want to know who's putting a gun to Kurt's head and asking him to pick this, because that's a very weird scenario to put a gun to someone's head about.
Brandon is very angry about the candy corn. So he has a candy gun that he got from his parents' factory and is at Kurt's home.
It's the Blackberry lobby.
I was going to say, I think Big Barry is coming for all of us.
Oh no, Barry White?
Yes. Barry White, also not a berry.
Yeah, I don't know where his seeds are.
Mike, you went full bloom. There it is. All right. I think that NeNe's coming back, and I think she's coming back because NeNe is a dessert. She's a person who does well with desserts. She's making a dessert as her third course. I think she's going to crush it with that dessert, and I think that will be the differentiator that brings her back to the competition. I think when she comes back, I would say Final Four. I think she makes it the Final Four. I think she was showing her chops significantly throughout this season. There's not going to be another Restaurant Wars type scenario to trip her up, and in this Restaurant Wars type scenario, she's showing, I think, the confidence and capability that she knew she had when she said she was going to take on the front of house job. She comes back. The chef testants come to the kitchen. She says, it's Restaurant Wars, bitches. And she's having a great time. She makes those prep lists for everybody. She's doing a great job of leading in the kitchen. They all want her to come back. I think it's Nini's to lose here. And I think she's going to come back. And when she does, I think what we saw from her in the competition previously, I think she'll do really well. So I would slot her for Final Four at least. We know a lot about her. And I think what we know about her and what her background is in terms of the types of cuisines she's comfortable with and her unique perspective on food, I think this all has the makings of a chef we're going to see doing well throughout the rest of the season. So I say Nini wins Final Four.
Yeah, I would say I agree. And I think if you look at the first two courses that these two end up making, the biggest dish that has the most critiques against it is Brothers 2.0 Tempura Jalapeno Popper, where Tom still doesn't feel like he really took the criticisms, even though he does improve a lot on those with the scallops that he does make. Nini has been doing consistent in her first two courses. And like you say, Antonio, I think she's going to knock it out of the park in the final course. So I agree. I think Nini's going to come back. Unfortunately, Brother is going to become the Russell Hance of Last Chance Kitchen in that he's going to make it to the end twice, but end up losing each time. And I think that she'll make it far. I'm going to say at least the finale. So I'm going to say like fifth place, maybe at least. But I think that she's definitely poised to go far. I think that, as Justin says, Restaurant Wars was sort of like a fluke in that it wasn't necessarily testing her set of skills that's inherent within every round of Top Chef. And so I think she's just going to pick herself right back up and dust herself off and just keep blazing forward. So we shall see. Any other thoughts from any of you three about the two-part Restaurant Wars, the two-part LCK, what we have to look forward to?
Yes. Three things. One, we're to assume that that Last Chance Kitchen continues, correct?
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. Secondly, how much of minds blown moment would it be if we get to Final Eight and they're like Restaurant Wars?
I mean, I do not think it would be a good idea. My mind would be blown, but not in a good way.
Yeah,
I think that the chefs would be horrified. I think the only time they did this was in season 4. They did a Restaurant Wars and they did a Wedding Wars. So maybe if they do another big two-team challenge, that might be comparable. But I don't think they're doing another Restaurant Wars.
I am looking forward to seeing what I think they will do something special at Final Eight. I just don't know what.
It's in Kentucky, so maybe they do Civil Wars.
Oh, God.
Oh boy.
Well, they did the American Revolution in Boston, so it makes sense.
Yeah, never forget the Thanksgiving challenge as well in Boston.
And then the third thing is I do think it would speak, I don't want to say poorly of the show, but for us to have three consecutive seasons where the winner is a Last Chance Kitchen returnee.
Yeah, which was my prediction that, Mike, you didn't ask for, is Brother Luck is going to get back into the competition. He's going to get knocked out almost immediately. Then he's going to win Last Chance Kitchen again, and then he's going to win Top Chef. And where are you now defending Last Chance Kitchen, Antonio?
Sorry, I love Top Chef and like seeing more Top Chef every week. I really apologize for that. Apologize. I love it so much. I enjoy extra content.
I think some good Wiggler rage is a nice place to end on.
On a Sunday, though. Let me say, I want to say one more thing. I'm looking forward to the Seelbach Hotel on Top Chef next week. That's a hotel where we're going to do our 1920s extravaganza. That is a hotel that has connections to the 20s. Mike, you said Great Gatsby. It is a hotel that is inspired. Well, there's a hotel in the Great Gatsby that is a pastiche or like a representation of the Seelbach, where Tom and Daisy get married. F. Scott Fitzgerald stayed in this hotel in Louisville, famously was kicked out of the hotel in Louisville for drinking. They have a beautiful Rathskeller bar. Al Capone and other gangsters used to frequent this hotel in the 20s. So it's a great Louisville landmark and a great way to, I think, show this aspect of the old city of Louisville and show that off. So that should be really fun next week. And that's one of those things where you can put costumes on Tom and Padma. You can have a lot of fun with that. So very much looking forward to getting back into the Kentucky swing of things next week and what I hope will be a very fun challenge.
And we're looking forward to getting back together as well in any conglomeration that we are to keep moving through Top Chef 16. We're going to have somebody back. I want to sort of take it as like maybe a soft reset on the season, as it were. We're going to move forward with 11 chefs and see what the rest of the season provides. I agree with you, Antonio. It'll be nice to get back into some Kentucky stuff. If you have any thoughts about the season so far, or about this episode, or about blackberries, you have a myriad of ways to reach out to us. You can always follow all of us on Twitter. Antonio is at AC Mazzara with two Z's and one R. Kurt is at Kurt Clark with two C's. Josh is at Round Howard. I am at a Mike Bloom type. You can also check out my aforementioned Top Chef Exit Press. I have my interview with Pablo up, still waiting on some answers from Nini, but that should hopefully be out before the next episode. Gentlemen, do you have anything that you'd like to plug in terms of material that you're putting out there into the ethos?
Antonio and I just podcast about The Haunting of Hill House. It's on Post Show Recaps, and it was a very fun podcast.
It's a great show, great podcast. Mike, I know you covered that show, so I hope you enjoyed it as much as Josh and I did.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of it right now, and it's reinvigorated. You know, I haven't thought about the show in a few months just because it scares me sometimes, but I was happy to be happily reminded of all the frights and tears and happiness, as honest as it is to say, that comes out of that fantastic show. And if you're in the mood for other PSR stuff as well, Jessica, Lisa, and I got together to talk about Bandersnatch, the feature film debut of Black Mirror on Netflix that came out a few days ago. You can choose to, or you can choose not to, but it'll end up in your feed either way.
There are Choose Your Own Adventure Survivor books, Mike. I don't know if you know this.
Okay, well, yeah, I think...
Go on to eBay or Amazon. You can pick them up first few seasons.
I think you might have just given me some ideas for the B&B coming next season. So thank you, Antonio. No. I'm going to give you credit because of that. But we'll be back next week to talk through episode 6 of Top Chef Kentucky. Thank you all so much for listening. Josh, Antonio, Kirk, great work as per usual. You may now pack your knives and go.